Do you like listening to those ads, or would you rather hear an ad-free version of The Gist? Well, it's your lucky day, because in the lab, we've developed such an animal. It's like the vegan meat of podcasting. Go to subscribe.mikepesca.com to become an ad-free subscriber, or choose from other tiers with additional bonus content. And they all taste like chicken. Enjoy the show. It's Friday, December 20th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And the government shutdown might happen. I say might happen because even though government shutdowns usually don't happen, there are some different dynamics at play. And of course, by the time you hear this, the government shutdown might have been averted. Shutdown averted. It's a little different from government running smoothly. But that's the best we can grasp onto. Usually, neither part of the government wants to really shut it down. And those doing the shutting down are the majority party, in this case, the Republicans. And in fact, almost all cases, the Republicans. And they remember when Newt Gingrich shut the government down and it didn't work out for Republicans. But that's when there was an election on the horizon to punish someone. We pretty much couldn't be further away from an election as we are now. So that's one reason why the government shutdown could happen. It'll take years before anyone gets punished. It'll take a shorter amount of time for Republicans who once agreed to Mike Johnson's deal, who are now reneging on that. It will take a shorter amount of time for them to get primaried, as Elon Musk, the main driver of discontent, wants to remind them. The other reason why a government shutdown might happen is that Elon Musk, the main driver of discontent, the bee in the collective bonnet of the Republican caucus, is that you would think he has a strategy for this. I mean, he's causing a giant amount of chaos in a fairly big country with not medium-sized stakes, higher than medium. So maybe he's doing it for a reason, to get some more concessions. On the other hand, Elon Musk isn't always a rational political actor. Elon Musk hasn't for a long time. Elon Musk has actually only been a political actor for a short time. He's always been a guy who pops off on Twitter. So usually if it's someone in politics, even Donald Trump, who was doing the popping off, you would say, well, what's the political outcome? With Musk, there might not be one. So if there's no political outcome in mind, no driving of a bargain, no trying to get last minute concessions, then it's more likely there'll be a shutdown. I would think that someone who could cause a shutdown, who could scuttle a deal, would only do so with a goal in mind. I think Musk might just like the attention, or have a fit of pique, or really want the Washington Commanders not to get that $3 billion stadium from taxpayers, which won't happen and was never going to happen anyway. The other thing about the government shutdown is there will be pain. There will be pain among government workers. But will it be enough pain over the holidays for regular people who don't know someone who works in a VA hospital or for the TSA? Will it be enough pain to be distributed for the public to clamor against it? Normally, we would say, well, CNN and MSNBC and even Fox would have to cover it. But look at the lesson of the election. MSNBC, CNN, these entities seem to only exist as touchstones for irrelevance. It's like, as a sports reporter for many years, there was a trope of higher ratings than the NHL. And you could plug that into the ratings of just about anything. You know, NASCAR has much higher ratings than the NHL. You know, women's ice dancing has higher ratings than the NHL. Don't get me started on darts and snooker, higher ratings than the NHL. So that's a little bit like the ratings of MSNBC and CNN these days. And those are supposed to be something of the warning signals for a society. So I would say that either I've been proven totally wrong and I've just wasted your previous 3 minutes, in which case I have a way to make it up for you, or these could be reasons where there could be a shutdown. Now, here's a way to make it up. Joining me now for the whole show is Jesse Eisenberg. He is out with a new movie. It is called A Real Pain. And yet it is a real delight to watch Mr. Eisenberg in his directorial sophomore effort as a writer and a star working alongside Kieran Culkin as two cousins who traveled to Poland on something of a trauma tourism visit. It's a great interview. Of course it is. Jesse gives, you know, we in the interview business, we talk about givers. And this guy's a giver. Jesse Eisenberg, A Real Pain, not a description of Jesse, just the movie he stars and wrote and directed, up next.
You know, Grandma never pitied herself. In fact, she always told me she was grateful for her struggle.
Well, that's just it. What she endured, that gave her hope, right?
Yes. In fact, she used to tell me that, like, you know, first-generation immigrants work some, like, menial job. You know, they drive cabs, they deliver food. Second generation, they go to good schools, and they become, like, you know, a doctor or a lawyer or whatever. And the third generation lives in their mother's basement and smokes pot all day. I mean...
She said that?
I think she was, like, just speaking generally about, like, the immigrant experience.
I lived in my mom's basement.
She was just talking about immigrants.
Okay.
That's all.
Yeah.
A Real Pain is a new movie by the writer, director, and one of the stars, Jesse Eisenberg. The other star is a guy named Kieran Culkin. He's very good in it, I have to say. Two cousins go to Poland to visit their grandmother's house before she was taken away to the camps and eventually made her way to America. Jesse Eisenberg, welcome back to The Gist.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Cousins are interesting, right? Because they're not friends. We don't choose them. And they're not siblings. So we don't have that. We don't have an obligation to them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and then cousins will have the same grandmother. So how do you decide to base it on cousins? Because there are a number of different options for the relationship between your character and Kieran's.
Yeah. I mean, the movie actually started as a separate movie script that was about these two friends, and they were going back to Mongolia for other reasons. And when I shifted it to Poland, and I thought that they could be, you know, having some, you know, this tie to their grandmother, to who grew up there, I just thought it'd be more interesting to, you know, have them be cousins who are kind of like estranged. And, you know, when you lose your grandmother as cousins, you in some ways kind of lose the connective tissue between the relationship. And then it's kind of up to you. You become kind of more in that friend area where you can kind of make the decision to kind of, let's say, continue diverging or decide that you're going to overcome your personal differences and get closer.
Now, I think I know what David, your character, wants from Benji, which is, he more or less explains it. And David is the character who's functioning and moving through the world. So at least to me, who I like to tell myself I'm doing that too, I can relate to it. What exactly do you think, other than a vague sense of love or belonging, what does Benji want from David on this trip?
Yeah. You know, Benji is somebody for whom life has kind of, you know, passed him by in a confusing way. And he's somebody who kind of exists moment to moment. And he has kind of, you know, difficulty shaping that into something a little more cohesive. And what he wants from my character is to, when we were younger, his behavior was really wonderful and celebrated. And now it's kind of seen as a bit maladaptive in society. And so he's trying to recapture this relationship he had with his cousin that made him feel empowered. When David, my character, would cry about everything, and when I was a kind of wreck, when I was a little kid, you know, he was the one who can be in control of me. And now he sees that I grew kind of out of the realm of his control, and it kills him. And so he keeps wanting the old David back. And he thinks by going to Poland and experiencing this kind of trauma tourism, maybe he'll get his old David back, who's crying and falls asleep, and who could kind of, you know, need him in this way that made him feel good about himself. Benji.
Yeah. Now, you were kind of like that. The guy who cried about things.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of the character's flaws were, yeah.
Do you think you just grew out of it, medicated yourself out of it? Maybe there was some conscious rewiring of the brain to get past that?
Yeah. God, that's such an insightful question that I would have expected to be asked 20 months ago in terms of my promotion of this movie. But of course, you're the first one to ask it, which is, yes, I knew when I was younger, I knew when I'm an adult, I'm going to be fine. I just knew it. I just had this sense, you know, I missed a year of school. I was institutionalized. I could not be in school. And I knew when I'm an adult, I'm going to be fine. And I started doing like theater when I was like 14. And it really got me out of whatever it is I needed to be away from. I don't know what it is, but I knew when I would be an adult, I would be fine. And that's kind of what happened. I got, you know, I was able to kind of like just have agency over my life, meet people that I kind of liked, you know, artsy people, people who felt outcast in their suburban lives as well. And then in term, but I still had severe amounts of personal anxiety. And I think that might be medicated away. And I wonder what damage that's done to my creativity, zest for life, my highs, et cetera. I don't know. But I do think, yeah, a lot of it's been medicated away.
Well, I was thinking about the creativity and the artistry. And I don't know, maybe it's the case that having, or the openness to experience that will compel you or a person to cry, that's useful for the artist, right? That's taking in the information.
Yeah.
But then having the maturity to push that aside and not being beholden to that, right, that's needed in terms of the output.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, it's the thing I like, ask my
therapist. You probably feel a little like you're glad you don't cry about all the horrors of the world, but you question, am I out of touch? Am I losing that part that's necessary to the artistry?
Yeah. I mean, you know, my therapist assures me every time he re-ups my dose or perhaps heightens it, tells me that it's not going to do the thing I'm worried about, you know, which has kind of sapped me of any creative energy. You know what I did notice, though? It was very strange. Like, once I started taking like these antidepressants, like maybe like 15 years ago or something, like I did notice actually I was more emotionally available on sets, on movie sets, in characters. I would often before that kind of like freeze up as an actor when there was a big emotional scene because I'd put pressure on myself.
Yeah.
And now my emotions were right at the surface, but not in my life. So like now I cry very little in my real life, you know, and yet in characters, I find it's right at the surface. So I don't know what that is. It's so strange. I'm sure, you know, there's a great Onion headline from 20 years ago, which was that Ritalin cures next Da Vinci. And it was like, you know, I think about that all the time. I mean, not to compare myself to Da Vinci, and I'm not on Ritalin, but just the idea of like, are we stifling the thing that makes us special? And I don't really know the answer to that, but I do know I can kind of function and I'm a fine dad and all that stuff.
Yeah, but probably antidepressants saves the next Van Gogh.
Yeah, that's a great point. You're right. That should be, you should do rebuttals for a satirical newspaper, The Onion.
Well, then I'd be the Babylon Bee.
That's true.
I want to be the middle ground.
That's really true.
So I heard you once say that on, I think, the set of Adventureland, you had this freeze-up panic attack.
Yes.
And the director there intervened.
Yeah.
And the way you told the story then was this very a copious amount of kindness towards, who was the director?
Oh, Greg Mottola.
Oh, yeah. He's great.
From your old stomping ground. Yeah.
Right. So, but in fact, it wasn't just these words that Greg Mottola said that oriented you. It was, there was a medication part of it as well.
Oh, was there? What I had said was like, he took me aside and basically said, I don't understand how you wouldn't be having panic attacks all the time. I don't understand how any actor does what you're doing.
Right.
And it just, it was revelatory for me because I always thought that what I do is this selfish vanity thing. And that put into perspective like this thing of, oh, maybe there is this special thing that actors do. And yes, of course, there's this vanity element. And of course, yes, there's, you know, they're getting paid, you know, disproportionately to the workload, et cetera. But like, you know, now that I'm on set directing and I watch how actors kind of like are exposing themselves and kind of, you know, just, you know, pushing through, you know, emoting in front of 100 people, I now think of it as this amazing, real sweet gift and, you know, generous thing to do. In terms of medication, I started it a few years later and I haven't had that. I have not froze up again. And I used to have it way more, you know, I used to have it during plays. You know, I would go on stage and like run my whole play before the play started because I was so panicked that I would have a kind of panic attack during it.
Uh-huh.
So I would pre-panic. I would run through everything, you know, and kind of get all that stuff out so that I could do the show.
So on Wednesdays when you had matinee and evening performances, it was four times?
A long day. It was a long day. You know, it's like what the Rockettes do. They'll do four shows a day. They don't realize I was doing that off Broadway for years.
And then Santa comes in at the end and gets all the credit.
Yes, exactly.
Goddamn guy in the red suit.
Yeah.
So you said that Kieran's character, Benji, lives in the moment. And okay, it's true. If you watch the movie, you could see. But I did note that in one of his great scenes in the cemetery, he tears into the very sweet tour guide.
Yeah.
And then a couple of scenes later, he seems to have no memory of that.
So is
that living in the moment? Or I want to ask you another question about the character and his particular mental makeup. But did that come from just this, what we call living in the moment, or is there a sort of diagnosis that you could look up in the DSM-5 that would correlate to what Benji has?
I think it's probably a little bit of both. And I was writing, I forgive me if this sounds like pretentious or, you know, artsy fartsy, whatever, but like I was kind of writing not from like, you know, a calculated diagnostic perspective, but I was really just writing from my unconscious and letting this character that I've written before in various plays and that I've written about in short stories kind of just speak himself. And so I wasn't really kind of like thinking like, oh, this kind of person would do X, Y, and Z and then not remember it in this X, Y, and Z way. And so it just seemed like the kind of thing like, you know, he's driven viscerally and maybe there is some manipulation there. And so if there's manipulation, perhaps he could be kind of performing not remembering that he said that. So perhaps it is something like that. But he's somebody for whom kind of like he trusts his own wavering moral compass and instinct more than the average person. And so he can become kind of like, you know, moralistic at the drop of a hat and then also, you know, hypocritical because he's somebody that just kind of trusts his own instincts in a way that I think other people would filter out or be more suspicious of.
Well, should he? Does that serve him?
It's like serves him in like I would say these transient ways, in these small ways. Like I would say I wouldn't like, you know, he'd be somebody for whom, you know, a long sustained relationship might be difficult, but, you know, within a 2-hour span would be the greatest 2 hours you've ever had.
Yeah, that's true. And so he's more suited to our TikTok generation. Well, also, it shows that the advice to thine own self be true. Well, I think it was that advice was probably given in the context of mocking the person giving the advice, right?
right.
But anyway, what does it really mean? It can mean drive yourself over the cliff or, you know, don't take any shit from anybody.
Right, of course. Yeah. I'm sure a therapist would look side-eyed at somebody saying, I just wanted to be true to myself.
Yes.
That in that moment, which is kind of a meaningless popular phrase.
But I was thinking about writing a play and doing it from your consciousness and you understanding the characters. 100 years ago, 400 years ago, Shakespeare didn't have any of the understanding that we do of how the mind works. And there was nothing like the DSM or Freud.
Right.
But he tapped into character and he might have gotten some parts of what we would now label a disease or a disorder wrong. Now, I'm comparing it to Shakespeare. But I wonder, as a playwright, is there is there a trend now or is there a pressure to write characters who have, you know, certain personality, let's say disorders, in a way that very much aligns with the disorder? You don't want to give the impression that someone who has, let's say, ADHD, if you very much know what that is, shows some signs that someone who actually had it wouldn't have. I wonder if there's a little bit of pressure to do that. And I wonder if we're better off maybe getting it wrong in the diagnostic sense, but that actually helps the dramatic sense.
Oh, that's such a fascinating series of questions. And my first thought really is that I would never in a million years think to write somebody who has a particular diagnosis because I'm just not an expert and I'm an idiot. My dad is a PhD in social psychology and has studied this and is an academic and would obviously caution me against writing about, you know, somebody who has a particular diagnosis. But the other reason that he would probably caution me against it is because mental illness manifests in people in very different ways. And you could argue that for, you know, there are as many mental illnesses as there are people with them, because you're talking about something that is pathological or diagnostic, but manifesting through somebody's personality. And you wonder where one begins and one ends. And then, you know, the other thing is I'm really just interested like in people. And I tend not to like, you know, think like, oh, this person's interesting because they have ADHD with a side of this or that. You know, I just find people so fascinating. I've been spent the morning reading about this new phrase I never heard. Have you heard of this phrase, this word called paltering?
No.
P-A-L-T-E-R-I-N-G. Paltering is fascinating. And I've been wondering what this is for so many years, but I finally found the name for it. It's paltering, which is that it's not, you're not lying. The way they define it is it's not a lie of omission or commission. It's a lie where you tell the truth. Yes. But it somehow is lying about something bigger. For example, you know, you ask me when, you know, I'm selling you a car and, you know, an omission would not tell you that it broke down yesterday. And a commission would tell you that it's great yesterday. But a lie of paltering would tell you that, you know, I've been driving it for years and I had a great time in it. So you're telling the truth technically, but you're kind of using that truth to tell a bigger lie.
Ah. And is this named after St. Paul who lied about Jesus or Paul being dead in the Beatles? I'm wondering which
Paul. It's an archaic term from English that doesn't have to do with what you might. It was a shock to me where it came from. It's an archaic term. But I thought that's just so fascinating. I've been writing.
Paul lied, said I'm going to fight Mike Tyson and really try.
And reappropriate it through him. Yeah. They're both brothers. But I think, you know, for me, like I've been writing characters that do that a lot. And I never had a term for it. But I knew people like this. this, and I grew up with people like this, and I would find it so irritating. And this is something my wife and I talk about all the time, because I think I judge a person because of their paltering more than any other aspect of their personality or crimes or good deeds. If they palter to me, and I never been able to put a name to it until this morning, but like, that's the thing, I, you know, when somebody is telling me a technical truth, but I could tell it's masking something, I don't know why, for some reason, it just eats away at me. And, you know, I've been writing about people like that for a long time, but it's not because I knew of the terminology through, you know, some academic manual and then kind of applied it to characters.
Do you think having the words for it, as they say,
yes, it's not helpful?
It's not helpful,
well,
right?
No, because now I'm, you know, I'm thinking of this used car example that ChatGPT gave me when I asked it to give me an example. And suddenly now it's like codified in a way that makes it less fun and edgy, and it makes it less of a mystery that I want to explore through characters.
Right. Or the next time you create a character 10 years ago, before people knew about paltering, they said, oh, you're really touching on the vagaries of human experience. And I was like, oh yeah, this guy's a palterer.
Yeah, classic palter. Another paltering story?
1.0.
Yeah, exactly.
And we'll be back with more of Jesse Eisenberg in a minute. We're back with Jesse Eisenberg, writer, producer, one of the main actors in A Real Pain.
Shit, look at her.
Who?
That woman, Marcia. She's walking alone. We should go talk to her.
We just met her.
Yeah, but she's got this, like, deep sadness behind her eyes, you know?
She does?
Yeah, you didn't notice that?
During the introductions? No.
I think we should check on her.
Benji, maybe she wants to be alone.
Sorry.
No one wants to be alone, Dave. Okay, I'm gonna check it out. Hey, why are you walking alone? Are you a big fucking loser?
Seriously?
So this movie is based on the two main characters. You mentioned this. You've written Benji before. I mean, Benji, he's come up in different plays. You played Benji in one of the plays. You played David in one of the plays.
Yeah.
Is that some sort of superpower? The fact that you can, without even knowing what you're doing, you can essentially do rewrites or pre-writes, not on the page or not even in a staged reading.
Yeah.
You can actually have it play out in a theater to see how people react to it. And then those characters become, there's an alchemy. You marry it to the Polish experience, and then you have this this fantastic product that
so
benefits
sweet.
From everything you put into it.
That's so nice. Maybe, but again, I don't feel it's like calculating. I think I just
it's not calculating.
Yeah, I think I just have like very specific preoccupations, like probably anybody who writes similar thematic, you know, personal stories over the course of like a career, which I, you know, haven't finished my course. I'm new, but like, I have these preoccupations with people like this, with why is my life good and somebody else's life is not good. And those plays are kind of about that. And the way we react to feelings like that. And sometimes we have resentment towards the person whose life is not good because we feel like we want that suffering to give us meaning. And sometimes we have a deep amount of shame and guilt because that person's life is not good and ours is. And that's kind of what this movie is a bit about. And it's just the preoccupations I have with my own, I don't know, kind of lucky life in comparison to the struggle of my forebears, you know.
Now, the character of Benji is very similar to this character of Ben in The Spoils.
Yeah, wow.
And the character, this is what's really, really fascinating to me. It's a great character, fully formed, but you were the one American, the one New Yorker who is in the TV or movie industry who didn't watch Succession, apparently.
Right, right, right.
Right.
Yeah.
Because you hate popular things.
Yeah, yeah. At the time. I'm sure I'll like them when they're...
Well, I don't think there's going to be a backlash for it to become unpopular.
No,
that's
of course not. Just like when they're not at the coffee cooler. What is it? The water cooler.
The water cooler that is spiked with coffee and, you know, to increase productivity.
I don't know. The water cooler.
But I understand not liking popular things. It gets you out of boring conversations at parties. Oh, have you seen the new Succession? No, moving on.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So but the thing about Succession and Kieran Culkin's character, which you never saw, is that he speaks in a certain rat-a-tat way. He comes up with phrases, and very specifically, a lot of things are fucking this, and why would you put this on the fucking headstone? And the character of Benji, which you wrote, Ben in The Spoils, he uses fucking almost as much and to the same extent as Kieran Culkin's character does in Succession.
Yeah. What it is I'm using it to kind of like, it's offsetting a class thing. So in the play The Spoils, he's roommates with this very sweet, earnest Nepalese business student.
Yes.
And that guy speaks in this kind of proper way. And Ben, in that play, to offset the thing he hates about himself, which is that he's a trust fund kid, speaks in this kind of crass way to kind of create a persona that makes him feel like, in his paradoxical and perverse set of ideas, also part of a struggle.
Oh, so you never saw Succession. That exactly describes why I didn't realize it. That's why I think his character was Roman Roy.
Roman, yeah.
That's why Roman does that.
Oh, okay.
That's exactly why Roman does that.
Oh, okay.
Because he knows he does feel guilty and he wants to be a man of the, not a man of the people, but he definitely wants to look down on hoity-toity privilege.
Of course,
people.
So right.
He does it through his language.
Yeah.
He does it through probably his inappropriateness, which also Ben had in The Spoils.
Yeah.
Okay, The Spoils is right here.
Yeah, I see that.
I have the works, and
yeah,
these
works.
Are great.
Oh, thanks,
the revisionist, you play David.
Yeah.
I don't think that character was so similar to the David
in
the
movie. No, it's not so much, just nominal.
Yeah. But that play was in Poland.
Yeah.
You've long been interested in Poland because you're Polish.
Yeah.
And so what were you trying to scratch with this play, and how is it different from A Real Pain?
Oh, yeah. God, thank you so much. It's so flattering. I knew you're a completist, but I didn't realize they'd be on hand. The play The Revisionist takes place in Poland. It's about a guy, David, who flies to kind of Poland, basically to just take advantage of his second cousin, who's a survivor, just so he can kind of get away, and because he has writer's block in America and he's trying to finish this shitty novel. And so he kind of takes advantage of this woman's house, but over the course of their relationship, they realize, you know, the kind of humanness of each other, and he comes to, and all of his kind of shame emerges, and her truth of her life emerges as well. And I guess I was trying to tackle a similar theme, which is like, you know, he's kind of blind and noxious in the play, The Revisionist, my character, but it's essentially a similar theme, which is, why is my life good and somebody else's life is not good?
Right.
And why, if somebody else's life was so bad and yet they survived enough to produce me, why am I miserable? You know, and why am I doing something stupid? Shouldn't I be the king? Shouldn't I be curing cancer? If they survived by, as we say in the movie, like 1,000 miracles, and they, you know, survived the Holocaust and produced me, why am I not walking outside and kissing the ground that I'm still alive every day? Why am I walking around miserable that they didn't have my scone, you know?
Yep.
And it's these kind of things that I'm preoccupied with, but I'm trying to kind of present these themes in a way that doesn't feel self-indulgent, but rather kind of, you know, questioning and entertaining.
Right. So in The Revisionist, David's character had those ideas. They're expressed in Benji's character in A Real Pain, but they're obviously your ideas. And they're ideas, I think, that I think if we think about the world and think about our ancestry or think about our forefathers and think at all deeply, it's really perplexing. And I can come up with answers that get us around the difficulty of the question, but I can't really answer the question. Like, how can the people we come from have struggled so much and we're such pains in the ass?
Yeah, exactly.
Their progeny is just such pains in the ass babies who can't move on from the world. And I guess the answer is, maybe if we were in that position, it would be better, or people do what they have to do.
Right.
But it is kind of one of those perplexing mysteries that should get you down about yourself.
Two elements strike me. One is that the two things are related. The fact that our lives don't have the same struggle means our lives are not imbued with the same meaning, because we don't have this very specific goal to survive or to, you know, immigrate to, in an attempt to succeed and work some menial job in order to make our children's lives better. Because we don't have those immediately kind of explicit purposes, we're devoid of meaning. But I also think there's something else too, which I think about sometimes, which is that perhaps those people, this is something, this famous director Ulla Grosbard, who's now dead, but it was one of the great European American directors, and he said, you know, we attribute wisdom to all Holocaust survivors, but it's often misguided, you know, it's often misappropriated, that, you know, we attribute great, you know, wisdom to people who survived great suffering, but a lot of times those were just the people who survived. In fact, maybe, you know, perhaps this, their toughness, their ability to kind of shut off allowed them to survive, and yet we imbue them with this great wisdom.
Also, I think there's a comedian who said this, or maybe I'm just doing the thing where I'm attributing this horrible thought to someone else. But like in the camps, there was the guy who everyone hated, right? Mm-hmm. There was, I'm not talking about the guard, like Jewish prisoner who everyone looked down on and thought was just a dick or a pain in the ass. And I guess that guy gets imbued with this great wisdom and character as well.
Of course. I mean, this is something that really kind of stayed with me, which is that we filmed this movie at Majdanek, the concentration camp near where my family lived. And they were talking to us about getting soup during the day. And the people in the front of the line would get the stuff from the top, which was basically watery. And the people at the back would get good soup because it'd be stuff at the bottom. But if you were too far back, you might not get soup at all. And so the kind of prime position was in the middle. And so you just think of like the jostling about, because people would probably figure this out.
Yeah.
And the jostling about makes me realize I would be killed in the first day because I'm not assertive. When I walk on a train, I'll let 17 people go in front of me because I don't want to kind of nudge my way onto the subway or whatever. So I'll take the next car and I'll be late and text somebody, I'm sorry that I'm running late. I didn't have the bravery to get onto the train. And, you know, so it occurs to me like, you know, who's the person surviving that? And, you know, what's the makeup of the person that can survive these, you know, these just horrible, you know, unfathomable, you know, horrific situations. And I often think it would just not have been me.
Oh, I think that, well, there's probably thousands of survivors who would have said that beforehand also.
Yeah, right? Yeah, that's true too. Yeah, I wouldn't have thought that right.
Majdanek was... I went through a researching the Holocaust phase about a year and a half ago, and I think it doesn't.
Terrible thing, huh?
Yeah, I'm against it.
Yeah.
Good soup notwithstanding.
Yeah.
Yankee Bean Day, that was okay.
You know, and that's why they did it on Jewish holidays. Yeah.
But
so a year and a half ago, what did you, what was the difference between a year and a half ago you and a year, you know?
Well, it was maybe a year and however much October 7th was. That is when I started.
But I mean, like, really. what did you research that you hadn't known before? Just like specifics?
Well, for instance, Majdanek, which is spelt weird in English, right?
Well, it's Polish, so it's M-A-J is my.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I didn't even know. I was so ignorant. I knew about Auschwitz, Bergen-Belsen. I knew the big camps, but this was a big or huge camp.
Yeah,
and
sure.
I just encountering that name or word and being a little confused about how it was pronounced, because that alone tells you, I don't know, the depths of my ignorance on this. And in my investigation, I did go online and they have the very scenes that you shot in. They have, you know this, right? They have, it's the most outward facing open experience to some virtual tourist. So you can basically walk through the halls that you walk through in your movie online.
Somebody told me this last week and I went online. Yeah.
Yeah.
Would have really helped 2 years ago when we were shooting and, you know, we needed to show.
You would have done some prep work.
Yeah.
But was it hard to get permission from them, or is this the camp that they're putting forward more than some of the other camps?
No, on the contrary. So the reason I wrote it is because this trip was based on a trip my wife and I took where I went to Majdanek. I didn't have family in Majdanek. My family was the people that were taken to a camp were sent to this camp called Belzec, which I don't know if you heard, or you would say Belzec,
yeah,
is the pronunciation. And that's not even so Majdanek is just the camp my wife and I went to, and I thought it was so eerie when I went there. You know, the distinguishing feature, I think, is that it was so far east that the Russians made it in before the Germans could destroy it. And so it kind of feels like it was liberated the day before. It hasn't been museumified really. No, but it was really difficult to get permission because, they don't want movie shooting there because probably every movie that approaches them wants to turn it into 1942, you know, and have it be a working Auschwitz. You know what I mean? It should be playing Auschwitz at 1942 rather than what I wanted to do, which was set it in 2022 and have it be, you know, a tour. So it took a while just to get in touch with them. And then finally, not just to get in touch, but to just plead my case, which was that I was trying to do what they're doing in another form. I'm trying to show audiences through this movie kind of what this place is and what happened here. And that's essentially their mission statement, but for tourism.
Do you think that being either Jewish or famous, or I don't know, maybe they wanted to get on the good side of history, were any of those a factor in them saying yes?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, the people who run these things are like young, brilliant academics who could have worked anywhere at any great museum throughout Poland.
But they're generally not Jewish.
They're not Jewish.
They're Polish.
Exactly. And for reasons that I've come to synthesize as just pure benevolence. They spend their days driving, parking at Majdanek, going to, you know, eating their lunch there and working every day to kind of memorialize, you know, essentially my family, you know, Jewish family's Jewish history there. Yeah. And so I just kind of
became, oh, that's right. Sorry to interrupt. They do it. What they're doing every day is what your movie was doing. And you're thankful they saw the overlap there.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah.
In terms of like, I just ascribe to them nothing but just really beautiful, pure motives. I mean, I got to know these people well, and they're just young intellectuals who find this calling, you know, the way you'd find somebody working in social service here or somebody who works here to kind of, you know, highlight, you know, marginalized historical groups in America. And you would just think, my God, thank God these people are devoting their lives to doing this.
What does the Polish government want people to know about Poland in World War II?
I don't know, because, you know, I hear criticisms about that all the time. And, you know, even from older relatives of mine who are saying, why are you going there? That government's... And it's just the opposite of my experience. My experience was working on a crew of 150 Poles who, like, you know, worked tirelessly to bring my family's history, you know, to light. You know, I found people who were working these monuments and these museums and all of the, you know, kind of connections that we had to make in order to get to shoot in various sensitive areas to just be so warm and welcoming. And I kind of walked away thinking, you know, my God, these people are spending so much more of their lives memorializing my family's history than I ever do.
Yeah. But they do want, I mean, there are many different Polish people and factions in the Polish government, as I don't have to tell you, a Polish citizen.
Oh, yeah, I know that government like the back of my hand. Yeah.
So there is a feeling in Poland that they would like the world not to think of them as collaborators. And that is overly reductive, but it is also complicated, right?
No, they were really sensitive to Obama misspeaking and calling it Polish death camps. And yes. I understand why. You know, they were German, you know, this is not my expertise, and so I don't even want to say anything about it. But my feeling just historically is, look at this country that's been overrun 1,000 times in European history. And, you know, we so easily travel to Berlin and Paris and everything, but then we consider Poland to be, you know, this, a haven for anti-Semitism. It just was not my experience at all.
What's the citizenship test like to become a Pole?
Oh, for me, my citizenship was outside the bounds of normal citizenship application. I basically said, like, you know, I have this deep connection to this place. You know, we lived here longer than we lived in the States. You know, there's such a long history that was just, you know, abruptly, you know, ended, obviously, and tragically ended. And I just thought, you know, if there's something I can do, because I found with this movie that I thought this movie could have kind of like, you know, just in its own small way, a kind of just rethinking of like Polish Jewish relations, because it's a pop culture thing and people are seeing it. And, you know, I've heard now from people, I'm going to go back to Poland. We just heard it about 10 minutes ago from your friend. And so like, I'm seeing that a lot. And I just thought if there's anything I could do to be helpful on creating better relationship between the Poles and, you know, Jews who come from, you know, Polish heritage, that's something I would be really interested in doing.
I would say not since John Paul II. Has there been someone to make that entreaty into?
And I was inspired by Carol. And and I think he knew at the time.
You do?
I think so. You know, he said, part of his sainthood was kind of the premonition that somebody would take the mantle.
And that boy would be born in New Jersey.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yes. Like the Dalai Lama, he saw me across the lake. And, yeah.
So I have one other stray thought, and then I want to end where I wanted to end. I just forgot to say it. You know, this vexing question of us being the inheritors of these amazing people and just frittering away so much of our life. It is also covered, and I know you're very familiar with his work, and that Simon Rich book and short story and that movie about the pickle maker.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Who had such a terrible life and then comes back to life and is like, look at these kids.
Yeah.
So there's a humorous way to do it. There's a serious way to do it. And you found a serial comic way to do it.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, when I read Simon's story, I think I tried to buy it. I mean, I think I tried to, like, I think Seth Rogen had the rights before I could get it. But, like, it was just such a, because Simon is, you know, a genius. I think you maybe called him a genius of the greatest premise, you know, conceiver in the world. You know, he's just such a genius. And the way he was able to kind of synthesize this complicated thing through this really funny idea is great. And, yeah, I guess I'm kind of doing my own version of that, you know, but through kind of a, you know, kind of self-questioning lens and maybe more of a dramatic approach or something. But no, Simon really, so clever.
So my last thing is the last thing. Are you one of those directors, writers, artists who will never tell the audience what to think or what to conclude about where the story ends? what I'm saying is, I don't want to give too much away, but the story ends and then we contemplate where the Benji character is and where he's situated. And I've seen a bifurcation over what it means, where he ends up. Mm-hmm. Is any interpretation valid, would you say? Am I being too opaque? Should I tell you what I mean?
Oh, I know exactly what you mean. And, you know, all I'll say is like, I mean, my favorite stories are ones that kind of make me think about them 5 minutes later, rather than ones that, you know, kind of answered the thought I would haven't even been able to conjure. And so, you know, this is not a movie about, like, you know, answers. This is a movie kind of, you know, it's talking about questions, and it's a character-driven movie where these characters have real voices rather than being kind of stand-ins for some political ideas or historical ideas that I have. And so, like, it ends in a way that's, like, very satisfying to me. But it's that kind of movie, you know. You have to be ready for that kind of movie.
Yeah, and I would also say, if someone wants the big answer ending, there are zero contrivances in this movie. I mean, obviously, the whole thing's a contrivance because, you know, you write it as fiction. But even the crazy adventures that these two guys take are only such because of their reactions. I mean, they go to the roof of a building, or they walk through a train and try to evade getting their ticket taken, that stakes being they'd have to pay $15.
Right.
But it seems like this crazy bonding adventure, and it's not out of, you didn't insert some Deus Ex Machina or some, you know, dramatic event that maybe wouldn't have happened in real life. So we can't expect that. If anyone criticizes the ending for not being, you know, spelling out what, where the character is left, I mean, think about that during the whole movie, I would say.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this movie was made for like $3 million. You know, the expectations for it narratively are to be thought-provoking rather than some kind of, you know, generalized pleasing device.
Yeah. Jesse Eisenberg, the new movie is A Real Pain. He wrote, starred, directed. Kieran Culkin's also in it in a big, amazing way. And if you haven't seen The Revisionist, it stopped playing about 12 years ago in the Cherry Lane Theater. Jesse, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you, Mike.
And that's it for today's show. We have a couple more shows before Christmas. Corey Wara is the producer of The Gist, and Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Leo Baum is our intern. Michelle Pesca is the chief compliance officer of Peachfish Productions. Umperu Jeeperu Duperu, thanks for listening.